Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Joseph Farrell, who, as you know, after each wrap-up, I invite to help me comment on the wrap-up and the stories of each quarter. And I find his insight on sort of the bigger picture of what's going on always to add enormous amounts to the wrap-up process. So I couldn't be more thrilled. I'm coming from Amsterdam, and Joseph is somewhere in the heartlands of America.
A man of mystery.
This is our first international broadcast.
Well, you know, we're always on the planet. That's what people say. You know, where are you? I say, you know, I'm still on Earth. I am still on Earth. So, Joseph, I just have to start because this was such an amazing quarter. You know, I look back over the last 3 months and I think, how could so much have happened in only 3 months? So I just have to ask you, you know, in such an intense period, both 2015 and just the third quarter, what was on your mind? What really struck you? What were the things that reached the top of your list in the third quarter 2015?
Well, there were three things, and I know I just said one of them to you before we started recording. One of them is Trump's swing at Common Core, which I think is going to be a political hot button in the election. And then the other two things were, of course, the Russian intervention in Syria and its very, very quick neutralization of the terrorist cells and so on there in conjunction with the Syrian army. And then playing into that, the third thing that I've been kind of tracking for a few months and just started blogging about on my website is the changes that seem to be apparent in Saudi Arabia. In fact, there's even I've even got a blog that I want to do after the conference coming up about someone else has also noticed this and is even blogging about the possibility that there's been some sort of coup in Saudi Arabia to reorient that country more toward Russia and break it out from underneath Washington's thumb, which if that's true, I mean, we've seen certain signals already. We've had the Saudi foreign minister or the Saudi defense minister going to Moscow. There have been some exchanges between Mr. Putin and Saudi leadership recently in the last quarter, which, you know, what we're watching is the unraveling, not only, as you put it in the quarterly wrap-up, of the Bretton Woods system, but we're also witnessing the unraveling of the geopolitical context for the whole system.
Right.
So, you know, these three things I think are going to, if they continue, and certainly Russia doesn't look like it has any intention of backing out of the Middle East anytime soon. Saudi Arabia doesn't look like it's going to be as subservient as it has been, or not subservient, but at least in the Western orbit, let's put it that way, as it has been
right
previously. And then,
well,
you know, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I'd
like to go through each one of these more carefully because I think
sure.
These are all very important
issues. And you know me, I'm burning up about Common Core, so I have to
start
there.
Oh,
yeah, me too.
I was astonished. I was, as I was leaving Memphis to come to Europe, I found myself in a local conversation with a group of women I didn't know, young women. And, you know, I never bring up political conversations unless someone else does, because you never know what people find energizing to talk about. And suddenly, you know, school year was just starting. When I tell you, Joseph, they are furious about Common Core and were in a state of complete revolution. To say that they were angry, it was unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it. And of course, the same time you had Trump out saying, you know, this kind of thing should be locally controlled.
Yep.
And the numbers I've seen is the thing that has most hurt Jeb Bush in the polls is Common Core. He's just taking it on the chin over Common Core. And I thought, you know, America is getting smart.
Yep.
This is a good sign.
It is a very good sign. And, you know, whether one supports Trump or not, you know, kudos to him for bringing up the whole issue. Common Core, for me, Common Core is a paradigm of what is wrong and has been wrong with American education for the past 100 to 120 years. And that is that a certain progressive element gained control of the processes of American education during this time period. It was really from the time period of more or less the Wilson administration on up to the post-World War II period, with people like James Bryant Conant at Harvard University, the president of Harvard, people like Henry Chauncey that founded the Educational Testing Service. And this was the whole move to create in American education, first of all, the requirement for teacher certification. Let's zero in on three of my pet peeves with American education. The three things are teacher certification, standardized testing, and the decay of scholarly standards in referencing. And let's look at each of the three of them, because Common Core really kind of knits the three together in an even tighter way than they have been in the past. Teacher certification, as far as I'm concerned, is how they gained control over education. To gain teacher certification anymore, you spend a great deal of time in education, so-called education classes, and basically wasting time, as far as I'm concerned, learning a bunch of claptrap, you know, methodology, educational psychology, and all of this nonsense. And you spend very little time learning the discipline that you're supposed to teach. And I saw this very clearly, Catherine, back when I was a professor. You know, I was a professor for OU and Langston University in Oklahoma. And I taught courses from, you know, European history, diplomatic history of the United States, things like classical philosophy, medieval philosophy, and invariably, Catherine, the dumbest students that I had in my classroom were education majors. Mm. And I would often engage those students to find out what it was that they wanted to teach. Well, I want to teach English, I want to teach history, and so on and so forth. And I have to tell you that my impression was, and it has not changed, and in fact it's only grown with my contact with other teachers in education and so on. Basically, the bottom line is that most people agree that when you get right down to it, it's all the time they spend in education classes compared to the amount of time they spend learning the disciplines that they're going to teach.
Right.
So my
they
first
never
thing
learned to master anything.
That's
yeah, precisely. They no longer achieve a competency in the disciplines they're supposed to teach. And this is the first thing I think has to go. To me, it's an absurdity. You know, it's literally so bad, Catherine, that, you know, I have a PhD from the oldest university in the English-speaking world. And to get that PhD, I had to display competence not only in my subject, but in Greek, Latin, French, German, Hebrew, you know, a lot of languages. I had to know the basic history of philosophy and the history of science and canon law and so on and so forth. So in other words, to me, it's absurd that with that kind of academic background, I cannot step into a public high school classroom and teach history without certification.
Right.
So, you know, this has become the way that they have exercised control over the educational process, because essentially what certification is it's a license to practice. And the other thing that highlights the inutility of these certification procedures is the fact that when you are a public school teacher, you then are required to spend X amount of hours every year in continuing education. So the school districts end up sending, you know, selecting certain teachers to go to these workshops and so on. And invariably, these workshops are more of the same. They're more indoctrination with the latest educational methodology, you know, the latest fad to come out of the teachers' colleges. Very, very seldom do you hear teachers having their way paid to, let's say, go to a seminar on English literature or go to a seminar on Oscar Wilde or Victor Hugo or somebody like this. So in other words, the professional development itself steers you away from knowledge of what academics is saying about their own subject matter. The second thing I think that is wrong with Common Core, and to me it's the real issue, everybody is focused on the Common Core standards, which are, if you listen to the explanations of certain things in mathematics, are certainly horrendous, but for me, the big focus of Common Core isn't the standards as much as it is the assessment process. Because what the assessment process is in Common Core is the standardized test, which has its own philosophical problems coming out the wazoo, if I can speak bluntly. It's an individually adapted, computerized, standardized testing process. So in other words, students are now taking their standardized tests on computers, and the computer adjusts the questions according to the students' responses. And all of this is being done by an anonymous group of people who've programmed the tests, who've come up with the test questions. So you're handing even more power over to the corporations that have created the standardized testing nightmare in the first place. So, you know, I can't begin how non-conducive to the educational process standardized tests are, because in no standardized test is the student allowed sufficient opportunity to explain his or her process of reasoning. You're simply regurgitating pre-selected answers. And now, with the adaptive assessment that Common Core puts into place, you now have a tracking mechanism, yet another level of surveillance on an individual from the time they enter the school system until the time they leave. And this assessment process is continuous and ongoing to the extent that it will be used as a social engineering tool to steer people into the selected careers that the system wants. And let me point out that this was precisely the goal of standardized testing to begin with. When Henry Chauncey founded the Educational Testing Service in Princeton, New Jersey, in I think it was 1948, 49, somewhere in there, when he founded that, his goal precisely was what he called the census of abilities. In other words, this was a mechanism that he and James Bryant Conant and other people in the educational oligarchy were deliberately designing to create a system, a meritocracy, to steer people into what they thought was their most optimum career choice. Now, I submit to you, you cannot have an educational system like this works, and we clearly see it doesn't work. You cannot have an educational system like this where there is no ability of the student to explain their process of reasoning in an interaction with another human being who's competent in the subject. So we can now add standardized testing to the teaching progressive philosophy. And what this does is it severe... Wow, I hear sirens going off.
Yeah, no, apparently it sounds... I know it sounds like I'm in the middle of a terrorist attack.
I've never heard it this bad, though.
Yeah.
And well, I'm tempted to ask what's going on, but let's ignore it. It will go away shortly.
Well, anyway, the standardized test, if you look at it, has only strengthened this educational oligarchy. I recall this very definitely when I was a professor, that they're teaching constantly to a test. They're not teaching their subject. They're teaching to prepare students for these tests, and that's it.
Although if they're changing the questions as the test goes on, a teacher can't even anticipate what the questions are going to be.
Exactly. And you know, I've had a couple of people already email me about their children in school have already been subjected to some of these tests. And you know, time limits, no opportunity to explain the questions. They can't study for the test because they can't anticipate what sort of questions. So this is a nightmare.
The most angry feedback I get, and I get a lot of angry feedback from parents, the most amazing feedback I get is from children themselves.
Yep.
You know, I sit across from 12-year-olds who explain to me how completely absurd this is. And you know, their unpacking of it and their explanation as to why it makes no sense
is very intelligent, very coherent. Yep.
They know that this is complete yaya.
Yeah, it is. It's nothing more than the latest gimmick, the latest technological obsession to come out of a politically corrupt class that themselves, you know, if we need to put it to the politicians, if you want this system put into place, you take these tests yourselves and see if you
can do well.
Well,
here's what I think they're doing.
I think they're trying to standardize the process so you can re-engineer the whole thing. You know, you can basically flip the cash flows into corporations. You can re-engineer the whole thing into private companies and intelligence agencies
who then
can exercise highly economic, very centralized control.
Yep.
So this
That's
is a
exactly
way of creating private monopolies
for both large corporations and re-engineering everything into publicly traded stocks. You know, so Microsoft is going to make a fortune, but the intelligence agencies are going to have direct access to every child,
you know,
because
they're going to have 24/7,
you know, databases on every kid on the planet is where this is going. And so, you know, to me, it's my, you know, I make it out to be much darker than you do.
No, I'm full square with you. I'm full square with you because I view this as a social engineering tool. I view it as another layer of the surveillance state. I view it as another layer for, you know, corporate looting of the public trough. I view it as nothing more than another mercantilist policy to favor the big corporations. And the bottom line is... The bottom line is, Catherine, that it is already demonstrably an educational failure. So in other words, this is also a system that is going to put America and any other country adapting a similar type of system into the bottom tier, because rest assured, countries like Russia, China, India, and so on are not going to go in for this. We can't have airplanes falling out of the sky because our airline mechanics have gone through the Common Core system and received a license to be airline mechanics at the end of the process who don't know anything about aerodynamics. But they sure do know how to be progressive and curb their language lest they commit microaggressions and all the other happy nonsense. You know, that is infecting our universities and our public schools. So, you know, now the third thing I think Common Core that is to me my pet peeve is what it's doing to scholarship itself. Because, as you know, when you read my books, I footnote according to the very old system of referencing that evolved over time in the academic world, places like Cambridge, Oxford, and so on, that evolved over time that allowed scholars to notate exactly where in a text they were getting a certain piece of information. So when you read my books, you'll find when I footnote something at the bottom of the page, you'll find the author's name, you'll find the title of the work, you'll find the place it was published, the year it was published, and the publisher's company name, and then the exact pages on which to find a piece of information or a quotation. Now, the standard in education courses themselves, if you go to take a teacher certification course, the way they teach you to reference something is to put a parenthesis after your citation with the author's name and the year of publication. And that's it. So you flip to the back of the book, if you're reading a book or your e-book, and you discover that the book that they're referencing is, what, 300 to 400 pages long. So in other words, they're simply saying, go look here. So this, and I'm telling you, Catherine, what this is doing is it's creating a dumbed down scholarly world, beginning with the teachers themselves.
Right.
Because if you go to education courses in this country, what they're doing is they're insisting that teachers use this method of citation. You are not allowed to use the older method, which gives you the exact page reference on which to find a piece of information, so that you can go there, look it up without spending undue time. It's creating, in other words, a whole group of lazy people and lazy authors, I might add, who no longer understand the necessity. And just imagine now, Catherine, if this method that is being pushed in the educational system, if this method of referencing things spreads to law, you know, the legal references are to court cases, exact citations, so-and-so versus so-and-so, such-and-such a year, such-and-such a court, such-and-such a circuit, and here's the pages of the decision. Imagine this spreading to law. Imagine this
spreading.
So here's
what it's going to do. It's going to make people dependent
on searchable text, which makes them dependent
precisely
on things that can be easily, can be easily changed and manipulated.
Yes, and you've touched on precisely the point I was driving at. What they're doing is they're trying to gain control over the canonical texts of the very foundations of our civilization. This is why, you know, I keep warning people, don't buy Amazon Kindle. Why do you think they call it Kindle? They want to burn books. They want to burn the standardized text that they cannot control. So what they're creating is a system where the information itself will be like the old Soviet encyclopedia. You know, when Yezhov comes a cropper of Comrade Stalin, well, we just go and crop the picture and take Comrade Yezhov right out of the picture. They don't even have to do that anymore. They can alter these things at the push of a button in a computer. So I urge people all the time, the only canonical editions of my books are the actual physical copy of the book from the publisher.
Right.
Amazon Kindle I do not regard as canonical because I don't trust them. Barnes & Noble Nook book I do not regard as canonical. If a book is worth having, it's worth having.
In the version,
you know, we don't want to give more control to these people.
Right. I couldn't agree more. Okay, well, you know, I will say this. The anger about Common Core is absolutely sufficient that, to my shock and amazement, as I sent you the other day, we have one of the blog posts on the Washington Post basically outright criticizing and taking on Bill and Melinda Gates.
I was in shock.
Yep.
Now, you know that's bad.
Well, it's bad, but it's also a hopeful sign that even some people in the power structure itself realize that you cannot sustain any form of American financial or economic or military power if you cannot sustain the culture undergirding it. And you cannot sustain that if you have an educational system that thinks it's going to get away with training people completely by robotics and faraway anonymous, you know, educators. And I have a book coming out next year, hopefully, about Common Core, where me and a co-author, you know the co-author, but we can't mention his real name publicly, where me and the co-author go through the public, the actual public record of standardized tests, and we point out specific examples of test questions from previous standardized tests, particularly in the realm of science, which were just plain wrong. Not just badly written, but wrong.
Right.
So in other words, you know, we're turning over our educational process to an elite that isn't even competent to make the tests. This is the problem. And hopefully people will realize that the whole system has to be torn down. You know, I'm proposing radical solutions here. Get rid of teacher certification, require academic degrees in the subjects that they want to teach, revert to local control of education at your local school board, throw out all these committees and get rid of the whole idea that there is a discipline called education. I know that's going to upset a lot of doctors of education, but I've got one in the family, and I can tell you, this guy is not only arrogant,
but he's
dumb. I
think it's time to get more radical. I think it's time to
pull your kids out of school and have a serious conversation with your neighbors about escrowing the taxes related to funding schools.
Yep.
If schools aren't going to serve the children that need to be educated and get a performance, then we need to think seriously about reengineering that money into capacity for ourselves again.
But
we can't be mandated to pay for something that doesn't work. So I'm with you. I think it's time to get completely radical.
Yep.
Okay, absolutely. Common Core.
So let's talk a little bit about Russia and Syria, because, you know, it's, you know, when I get more than 30 emails a day on a topic, you know, that's when I say the media is really focusing on this.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm the same way.
Yeah, it wasn't just Russia and Syria. It was the U.S. pulling out of the Middle East.
I mean, there's no doubt
the U.S. has significantly this year reduced their commitments, you know, including what they could do once they made the Iran deal, which is now done.
Right.
So, you know, and what was interesting is, I don't know if you saw the story, but basically our aircraft carrier sailed out just as the Russians sailed in. And I have to tell you, it looked very coordinated behind the scenes.
Yeah. Well, I think that there is possibly some coordination, but to me, Catherine, and you and I have talked about this in previous quarterly reports, we have discussed the idea that if there appears to be, number one, some sort of panic going on within the Western power structure, within the Western elite, the deep state, whatever you wish to call it, and we've also discussed the idea that there appears to be some sort of factional infighting going on between
them.
I think we've seen over the past 3 to 6 months with the Iran deal, with some of the statements that Mr. Obama has recently made regarding our you know, coming out and acknowledging our policy in the Middle East has been a failure. Well, I think this is an indicator that he has been on one side of this factional fight, and the national security structure, the Pentagon, the State Department, and so on, have been on the other. And the way that he phrased this admission suggests to me also that he's thinking in much broader terms, that the Zbigniew-Brzezinski approach to regime change, covert operations, you know, George Soros, color revolutions, and so on, has been a big, huge failure. And it has been. It has garnered us nothing but an extreme amount of hatred in that region, and our own allies are looking at us cross-eyed. We discussed the Warwicker trilogy the last time we talked, and how the British are now looking at us with eyes of deep suspicion. So we're losing our allies. Now, Russia in Syria, what's interesting to me to watch here is that Mr. Putin has really played a huge chess move here in two ways. The first thing that he's done is he's questioned the whole war on terror meme by going in and demonstrating, first of all, that the United States could have taken out these ISIS terror cells in Syria much earlier than it did. And the reason it didn't, he's also been very cleverly just kind of fueling the fact that most people know in the alternative community that the United States has financially created and supported these groups.
Right.
So, in other words, he's calling out the whole war on terror meme. The second thing he's done is he went before the United Nations and he pointed out that Russia had every right to intervene in Syria because it was a request from a sovereign nation, which is supposedly the rule of international law that we're all supposed to operate under. So in other words, what he's done is he's simultaneously portrayed the United States as the quintessential rogue nation on the world stage.
Right. Right.
And he's done this quite successfully. Whether you love him or hate him, the fact of the matter is he's done this quite successfully. The third thing that he did, which was the real stunner, and I'm watching this story unfold, Catherine, and it's another reason, the reason behind the scenes, that I think there's not only coordination, but that I think there's a certain amount of U.S. military comeuppance here. Russia launched those cruise missiles from the Caspian Sea, on warships in the Caspian Sea, all the way to Syria. Now, those warships were not supposed to be able to have that capability. So Russia sent a huge, huge message to the West, and to the United States in particular, that the dream of American military domination of Central Asia is a dream, because Russia has the capability, as he demonstrated, to intervene technologically with advanced weapons systems within 1,000 miles radius of the Caspian Sea, anywhere
right.
in that region.
Right.
This
right.
was a huge, huge message to the United States. The Russians weren't supposed to have that capability at all. The second thing that he's done that has also sent clear warning, I can tell you, Catherine, the warning bells went off in the Pentagon that they had better back down. And this is the fact that in the last week we've learned that Russia has created some sort of electronic communications blackout bubble over the entire country of Syria. So in other words, NATO communications systems, American command and control inside of Syria, Turkey and its command and control systems of its forces in northern Syria, communication systems are working. So, you know, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, oh, well, this is the reason that we had the USS Donald Cook incident, where that Russian fighter supposedly
right.
took down the entire computer and communication systems of one of our most expensive and costly missile frigates in the Black Sea.
Right.
And I think in retrospect now, what we see going on in Syria, that the Donald Cook incident was a trial that the Russians were running to see if this system, whatever it is working. And now they're deploying it when they found out it did. A couple years later now, we see what they've done in Syria. So I think behind the scenes, not only is there an element of coordination, Catherine, I think behind the scenes there's also an element of non-coordination. And I think that,
right.
that the U.S. military has beat a strategic retreat until they can figure out just what the heck is going on here and why all of our billion-dollar systems are not working when Russia is able to field systems far less costly and far more effective. It's really sent a huge signal to the fact that our military industrial complex is so awash with money that the money really isn't accomplishing all that much anymore. We're spending
right.
far too much and getting far too little bang for the buck. So Russia is sending all sorts of signals. I think this plays into what may be going on now in Saudi Arabia with the rumors of some sort of coup going on in that country and a massive reorientation. What Russia did is it sent signals to Israel and to Saudi Arabia. And now we find all of a sudden Saudi Arabia, with all of its American defense systems, is backing down from this model of open and covert confrontation with Syria and Iran. And
right.
trying to make nice with Russia in a really big hurry, which, you know, if I were them, I would too. You know?
Well, here's the thing. We just saw Saudi Arabia go out to do its first bond offering because their cash flows are plummeting.
Yep.
The fracking technology has really power shifted the Saudis in a very significant way. And now bringing down the oil prices is really putting them in a corner.
Yep.
And so with the Iran deal and the U.S., you know, the U.S. still has 45,000 troops in the Middle East. So we still have
a major commitment.
But clearly the Iran deal and the shift of the aircraft carrier out and the other changes, you know, we're basically pulling our horns back in and saying, look, we've got plenty of oil and gas domestically.
Yeah.
You know, we're prepared. You know, we're, every time you turn around in a whole lot of sectors, we're insourcing.
And
yes.
We're just saying we're standing down and, you know, we're pulling behind the two big oceans. We don't have to be there. And so all of our allies, wherever they are scrambling.
Yeah, this is the, I think you've put your finger on something else very significant that is happening, that is going to change financial markets, is going to change the geopolitical situation. And that is, we are leaving our allies kind of high and dry. And in a certain sense, they themselves have been kind of quietly trying to push us out of the picture. When Mr. Putin began this intervention in Syria, one of the things I was watching very carefully was how France and Germany were reacting to this. And then, of course, we had the French Foreign Minister, Laurent Fabius, coming right out eventually on French radio and saying that, you know, as far as France was concerned, you know, Mr. Putin's perfectly within his rights and go for it, you know. And I think really from the European point of view, what they're saying is, you know, better you go in there and do this and get this accomplished, because we are being overwhelmed with refugees, and not all of these refugees are going to be carrying a benign purpose with them. So in other words, this is being perceived, I think, quite rightly, although they'd never admit this, as national security threats in Paris and Berlin. And this, again, from the European point of view, is a situation almost entirely of America's making.
Right.
So, you know, we have managed to push, you know, the two most powerful allies that we have in Europe further away from us, and I think that's only going to increase. I've been saying this for years and years, that Europe really has nothing to gain now from its alliance with America, either militarily or economically. And this is particularly true in the case of the big European power, which of course is Germany. So I don't see anything else other than what you've suggested, Catherine, and I think you're right on target there. They're pulling in their horns. They're retrenching into North America. I think this is also part of it. We simply can't make this pivot to the Pacific work if we're trying to fight, you know, to use the old world.
Right, you can't do, it's one or the other. It's either or. You've got to get out of the Middle East. Got to step down in the Middle East if you're going to do the pivot to Asia. And they're going to do the pivot to Asia. They're committed.
Right. Right.
So
now there are two other things in this respect that I want to talk about. One, of course, is the stunning revelation that essentially the EU has rejected, or many countries in the EU and Europe has rejected, the GMOs.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. This to me is highly significant, Catherine. This is, you know, again, for many years I've been saying that there is a GMO geopolitics going on. And I think the GMO rejection in Europe is really geopolitics of a very high order in action.
Yes,
and here's why I think
absolutely.
That.
Yeah.
I think it is because Russia, again, took the lead in this whole field about 3 years ago. You had statements from the Russian agricultural minister, I forget what his name was. You had statements from Dmitry Medvedev and other people high in the Russian government that, first of all, Russia was going to ban GMOs altogether. And Putin came right out and said, you know, we don't need this. We can grow good, nutritious food, nutrient-rich food, and keep our soils not ruined from this process of the Western model of agriculture, and feed our population quite nicely, thank you very much. And the other thing that they did, which again fell right off the radar screen of the Western media, and particularly in this country, was that the Russians were also going to do long-range intergenerational scientific testing of GMOs and their effects on human beings and on the environment. Now, it's interesting to me that as this situation in the Middle East is playing out, that you had the European countries almost to the last member of the EU, rejecting GMOs either outright or in some form or fashion, beginning in Scotland, the United Kingdom, Germany, Hungary, France. All of these countries are rejecting GMOs. And I think the reason why is not only are they bowing to popular pressure in their own indigenous populations, but they are also trying to set the stage for a coordinated long-term alignment of European Union agricultural policy with Russia. So they're looking, in other words, they're looking for trade agreements with Russia.
Right.
So this is a huge development, and it's a huge blow, like it or not.
It's going to make the negotiations on the transatlantic partnership that much more interesting to see.
Yep.
What America does.
I don't think that's going to go well for the United States. And again, you know, the Monsanto model is again to blame. The idea that we can give all of these big favors to our big agribusiness corporations, and that they can go in and sue small farmers, you know, ma and pa farms, for the presence of GMO crops on their fields, which they haven't planted, but which entered their fields. You know, this has been the practice. And again, this kind of sharp practice, the end result was predictable when it was put into play in the first Bush administration back in the late 1980s. The end result
started
was predictable.
In Clinton.
Well, yeah.
It started
Clinton
in
too,
Clinton.
But,
in the, yeah.
Well, actually, it was Dan Quayle and George Herbert Walker Bush that started this whole thing of substantial equivalence with GMO crops. But the point here is you can't have that kind of sharp practice continue forever before people are just going to say enough is enough, we want you out of here. And that's what Europe is saying, basically, is we want you out of here.
Right, and I think that door is shut. It can't be opened.
No, I agree.
Another part of this that I want to bring up, which I think is very important, is one of the things that the United States did when we went into the Middle East in 2003 and 2004 is we poured money to really build out the concept of a private mercenary and private army. Obviously, we started it before when Carter first fired everybody at the CIA. Those were the seeds that really began. But there is no doubt that our excursion into the Middle East this time poured billions and billions of dollars into that infrastructure. And we now have a very significant and independent infrastructure of essentially private mercenaries and armies, which puts us really back into a medieval ages where
where we've created, you know, where force is no longer the monopoly of the nation state.
Right.
And to me, that is the very definition of a medieval situation.
It's not only the very definition of a medieval situation, but there's something else lurking in it. And I'm so glad you've brought this matter up. It becomes conceivable, and you and I have discussed this. We discussed this last year at the Secret Space Program Conference and some of the little informal discussions that were taking place. And it's worth mentioning that when you get to the point, and you've pointed this out many times, Catherine, that the United States government has lost control over its own databases, that these things are actually being run by the corporations. Well, let's expand that. Because corporations are also building our nuclear weapons. Does this mean, does the privatization of military force mean also that we could be looking at hidden nuclear powers in the form of corporations? Does it mean we could be looking at hidden, not just nuclear powers, but corporations with the actual ability to create directed energy weapons, both defensive and offensive weapons, and put these things into space? And therefore, is this the mechanism by which Mr. Global is doing an end run around international law and treaty in order to...
Oh, I think absolutely. Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, I do too.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, I do too. This is the... this is the breakaway civilization at work, and, you know, we're seeing it very, very publicly. So, yeah, I think this is the other thing that Mr. Putin, if you're watching his remarks carefully, I think this is the other thing that he's signaling, that Russia is not going to just simply roll over and play dead and accept, is this development which has taken place in the West. I covered about 2 months ago, Catherine, the merger of the big French armaments firm Nestor and the big German armaments firm Rheinmetall into one big, huge armaments cartel. And after this merger happened, then Germany at some arms fair show put on display Rheinmetall's drone busting laser system. Okay. So in other words, that was a clear message, you know, that they have this capability, they have this technology, and it's in Franco-German hands. So this becomes the mechanism by which Europe is going to create its international army. But more importantly, it gives you an idea that these corporations now have capabilities that, in the West at least, fall outside the purview of national sovereignties. And Mr. Putin has signaled very clearly his dislike and displeasure with this whole power structure in the West. And I've kept warning people that they have to understand Russia is the first post-postmodern state. And what Mr. Putin is really saying, what he's really targeting, is the whole playbook of memes of Mr. Global. The idea that the nation state is obsolete, obsolescent, that we have to deal with corporations now, this is what he's taking direct shot at.
Right. But although I believe Putin is getting more than a little bit of help from the city of London.
I do too.
I think that's, where it's coming from is the city. So part of this is the Hegelian dialectic
going on.
Yep.
But, you know, it's very interesting because I went back when I started to study the mercenary armies in fact, it was in the third quarter. And I really, you know, I'd never really focused on what was the Treaty of Westphalia
and how did it bring about
this notion that a nation state should have control of force and the application of force within its jurisdiction.
Right.
And what I realized is, you know, the United States simply brought down the Treaty of Westphalia without any confiscation or discussion whatsoever.
Yes.
And that is an absolutely,
I mean, that's an exponentially debasing development.
Well, let's look closer at that, because I think you're absolutely right. The Treaty of Westphalia was signed in 1648. It ended the 30 Years' War, which was essentially a religious war. And at the end of the treaty, there was a maxim that began to be applied in international law. And the maxim goes like this. Cuius regio, eius religio. And the Latin means, who's the region, his the religion. So in other words, the treaty basically, after all that fighting, said, well, if it's a Protestant prince, then they have jurisdiction over their culture, and it will be a Protestant state. If it's a Catholic prince, it'll be a Catholic state, and so on and so forth. And everybody will accept this and get along with each other. Now, this expanded into the modern era when it was applied to the world of Islam. And what the United States has done to break that system is precisely, with all of the meddling in the Middle East, with the color revolutions and so on and so forth, has created the refugee crisis where it's attempted to break the back of the growing European descent to American policy. I think a lot of this has been very deliberately targeted at Europe in a certain sense.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, I agree.
And again, Mr. Putin has stepped in with that speech that he gave at the UN, which was so important. I really hope people will go watch it. Some of the translation isn't the best. But basically what he has said is, again, he's taking aim not only at the meme of Mr. Global, that the nation state is obsolete. He's not only taking aim at the corporate structures of the West and their growing power and influence, but he's also taking direct aim at the idea that one nation can overturn what was essentially an international order that worked fairly well for the last 300 years, 300 to 400
right.
years. So, yeah, I totally agree with you. This is, you know, we're in a long-term cycle as well as a short-term cycle, and the long-term cycle that we're in is the unwinding of what was established during the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation and the resulting wars of religion and the Treaty of Westphalia. Absolutely, I agree with you.
Right.
Okay, so I want to turn to some of the issues under what I call leadership. Tag, you're it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a wonderful, one of the most positive stories I've read, and it came out, in fact, in October, but it really, you know, the survey was done in the third quarter among, as part of the period. And that was a survey by Chapman University about what the worst fears in America were.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was America's Top Fears 2015. You know what the number one fear was?
No.
Corrupt government leaders.
Yep. Oh, I can believe it. I can believe it.
Well, you know, whoever says the American people aren't smart, you know, it's
just when you think they don't know what's going on, you realize, oh, they do know what's going on. The number two fear was corporate invasion of private information.
Yep. Yep.
I think the number three was cyber hacking. Maybe I got the orders. You know, those were two and three. And then I think the next one was government invasion of private data. And then it was credit card fraud, identity theft, on and on and on. And they pretty much had it nailed. The only disagreement I had with any of the results was they were a lot less afraid about it. You know, it was only 58% afraid of government corruption. It should be 100%.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because in fact, we had
government...
Jimmy Carter had an interview during the third quarter where he said, the U.S. is an oligarchy with unlimited political bribery.
Yeah, and he's President Carter is exactly right.
Yeah,
he's exactly
absolutely.
Right.
Well, you know, it's funny. During the third quarter, there was an effort to get me out of the country.
You know, I got a very unusual invitation to leave the country to be far away on September 26th and 28th. And I made a couple calls and I said, what's this about? And they said, oh, they're trying to get you out of the country. And I said, why? And they said, to protect you. And so that's when I started to really dig in and look at that UN meeting. And I had to get all the way over, you know, I was in Italy, I guess, when the Pope came, and then I came to Amsterdam. And I have to tell you, I was so livid by what I was watching that I was very glad to be not in the country when it happened. Because I just have to tell you the spectacle of Americans treating with respect an institution which has been proven to do what this institution has done
in the last
30 years. I can't fathom it, Joseph. I can't fathom why people will tolerate that behavior from an institution and continue to treat it as credible because they've got a new face based on what that person says as opposed to what that person does.
And even there, what that person says is it's a liberation theology. It's kind of a soft Marxism. It's kind of it's window dressing when that institution has horrendous track records in the last 30 years. Your reference to the child sex scandals and everything else. But, you know, being kind of in the Eastern Orthodox orbit, you know, for many years I was formerly a member of the Orthodox Church. And if I were to ever go back to any form of organized Christianity, that would be it. You know, as far as the Orthodox Church is concerned, the papacy, you know, was excommunicated over 1,000 years ago. As far as the Orthodox
Right.
Church is concerned, it's the Catholic Church, not the outfit in Rome. And the reasons for that were very fundamental. They were the fact that the papacy had, on its own authority, more or less unilaterally changed official church teaching regarding the doctrine of the Trinity, that the papacy was making claims for its own office that were no part of the deposit of the faith. That, you know, and it's interesting to note that after this happened, after the schism between the Eastern and Western churches happened, Catherine, you had the rise within precisely the Western church of all these mechanisms of thought control, the Roman Inquisition, the various national inquisitions, and so on and so forth. You know, I've got Roman Catholic relatives, and I point out to them that the rosary, you know, the beads that are famous for devotional practice in the Roman Catholic Church, well, this was kind of the invention of Domingo Guzman, or Saint Dominic, as he's known in Roman Catholicism, who was the man that set up the Inquisition and presided over the slaughter, and I do mean that word, you know, with the full force of meaning, presided over the slaughter of the Albigensians in the 13th century, in the 14th century.
Right.
So, you know, this is an institution, you know, like it or not, with a long and bloody, bloody history. And
I'm convinced if you look at the numbers on Christianity and Catholicism that the war on terrorism is basically a response to the fact that in the early 90s Islam passed Christianity as the world's number one religion, and it was growing fast.
Yes.
And this was a geopolitical response, not just by, you know, by the G7, but by very much the Vatican and its investment networks. The, you know, how has the church always marketed itself in the, you know, when things get tough, they have inquisitions. So this is our first global inquisition.
This is the other thing that we have to remember about Francis. Francis came out, I think, about 6 months, 8 months ago, somewhere in that time frame, with a statement that Christians had absolutely the right and duty to defend themselves against Islamic attack.
Right.
And we have to, you know, we have to remember this. And, you know, I don't disagree with him, because you find very much some of the backing that Mr. Putin has for his intervention in Syria are coming precisely from the Orthodox Church. But with Francis, this is something very, very different. The other thing that we have to remember about Islam is, you know, and I tried to point this out in my last book, The Third Way, is that the West itself has consistently backed the most radical and fundamentalist elements within Islam itself as tools in its own geopolitical agenda, and also as tools to ward off any attempt of that culture to reform itself from within. And this, to me, is the biggest tragedy of the last 100 years, because, again, this is the signal of the end of the Westphalian system, is that this meddling within internal affairs with Islam have prevented that whole culture from reforming its own, you know, medieval barbarisms.
Right.
And there were, you know, this is something that we must remember. There were voices for this type of reform in Iran, going back to World War I, within the entire Muslim world, within the Ottoman Empire, within the Arab nationalist revolt against it. There were these moderating voices. So what did the West do? Well, in order to keep Islam backward, they backed the most radical and fundamentalist and you know, by the Sharia book elements of Islam, and we're paying the price now. You know, this is a very, very short-sighted policy. But Francis, I think, is I'm with you, Catherine. I think that in a certain sense he is a distraction pope. He's another John Paul II. Flying around the world and smiling and waving his hands and saying platitudinous, nonsensical things about climate change and all of this stuff, while the real crisis in the Vatican is, you know, the ongoing scandals of what's been happening with the clergy, what's been happening with the Vatican Bank, and so on and so forth. This is a very corrupt institution, and we need to remember this. There were good and weighty reasons.
It's what I wrote on the Pope's encyclicals. Like, well, how come you don't shift your own money?
You and your networks are in control of hundreds of billions of dollars.
Put your money
where your mouth
is, rather than telling everybody else what to do. Just shift your money.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So
the hypocrisy of it is this blatant.
Well, here's the thing. Anytime somebody flies around in a private plane and then preaches to me about my carbon emissions.
Yep, exactly.
I just don't take them seriously.
Well, I don't either, and nor should anyone else. You know, and when it comes right down to it, what really is this saying about the state of the Catholic Church, that it's no longer concerned with the celebration of sacraments, it's no longer concerned with maintaining Catholic faith and morals and so on and so forth? What it's really concerned about is public image and power. So, you know, again, I'm totally with you. This is my Orthodox background coming out again, but pardon me. I have no love lost for the papacy. I've never had any love lost for the papacy. It is, in the final analysis, as I said before, it is not a Catholic institution. People need to start decoupling the word Catholic from the institution of the papacy.
Well, you know, I was when Francis was coming to the United States, I was over at the Vatican visiting the Vatican Museum. And one of the things that struck me the most about the Vatican was how unhappy everybody who lived around the Vatican was.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, maybe you should come minister to your neighbors. Okay, so the next thing I want to ask you about is I literally in the third quarter I lost my temper. You know how hard it is for me. You know how much I work to stay in a state of amusement. You know, to me, we've got to maintain that higher mind. But I lost my temper, and the thing I lost my temper about was fear porn.
Yeah.
And
at one point, we put together a big presentation called "What's Up This Fall 2015." Where we literally went and did a calendar. You know, I said two things. I said a lot of things are coming to a head this fall in terms of political negotiations, and that's going to make for a very intense time. And I said the other thing is we're unbelievably overdue for a correction in the equity markets, you know, and there's trouble coming in the bond markets, and that's got to get reflected. And so I think very high chance of a correction. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. We had all the intense political negotiations and we had the correction. Now, in the meantime, what I was dealing with was just an unending amount of fear porn about, you know, religious apocryphal events and global financial crashes and all sorts of yaya that made absolutely no sense. It was completely nuts stuff.
Yes. And yet,
I can't tell you how many, you know, I've got very intelligent, very capable subscribers, and that stuff was getting to them. And I attribute some of that to entrainment technology. I don't think it's, you know, they're just too smart by and large. But there was so much of it that, you know, they started, you know, they'd start to think, well, there's, you know, maybe I should pay attention to this. And so I did an awful lot of work. We did an audio seminar, or we did a Salieri report called "What's Up This Fall," and did a big transcript and did something on shadow work, because the thing people needed to worry about was the shadow work. You know, whether it's credit card fraud, identity theft, all these different things that's eating up their time. That's really their big danger. It's the price of having rotten leadership who's trying to harvest you. That's a real danger. They got to protect themselves from it. But I really, Joseph, I admit it, I lost my temper about the fear porn.
Well, I do too. You see it all the time, and I get inundated with it almost on a daily basis. And quite frankly, I don't pay that much attention to it, you know, because they have been predicting doom and gloom for so long that at some point people are going to wake up and realize this is like the boy who cried wolf one too many times. And then the wolf finally does show up and no one pays any attention because he's cried too many times. This is the real danger.
Well, I don't mind them doing it.
What I mind is when I see people lose time and attention and focus to it.
Yes. Yes, I do.
So
too.
I what bothers me is the harm that it does.
It does a great deal of harm.
Yeah, it does.
Well, the thing is most of it that I see is usually based in some form or fashion, ultimately, on a particular reading or prophecy. That has created this apocalyptic mood. And I go back to something I pointed out with Dr. DeHart in our little book, Yahweh, the Two-Faced God. The whole rapture culture of modern America is, first of all, not traditional Christian doctrine. This is what people must get into their heads. This is not traditional Christian doctrine. Traditional Christian doctrine is that, you know, the sacrifice of Christ was once and forever. And therefore, there is absolutely no possible return to any system of Old Testament sacrifice or dispensation. And this is precisely what most American evangelical Christians buy into. And therefore, because they buy into it, they're constantly looking for through the tea leaves and so on to see fulfillments of biblical prophecy. And what they're really doing is they're preparing the ground for the very Antichrist that they claim to be against. Because any system that returns to that, returns to an Old Testament way of thinking, is really a denial of Christ. This is Roman Catholic teaching, this is Orthodox teaching, this is Anglican teaching, this is Presbyterian teaching, Lutheran teaching, Methodist teaching. You know, you go back and you look at the traditional body of doctrine of Christianity, and there is absolutely no hint or suggestion of what modern America, and therefore most people in the world, think is traditional Christian doctrine. It isn't. But what this has created, I think, particularly in America, is fear porn. We see it everywhere. It's created a culture of apocalyptic expectation, and people need to wake up and realize that every little twitch and wiggle in the financial system isn't the beginning of Antichrist. you know, if I can put it that bluntly, sure, those dangers are there, but the dangers come more from the assault on the image and likeness of God in man rather than anything else. We're not supposed to surrender our individual personal sovereignty or freedom. This is part of the spirituality of any sort of mainstream religion, be it Christian or otherwise.
Right.
And this is what so many people are really buying into when they buy into this stuff. I don't know how else to put it. This is where I think it's coming from. This is, I think, the effect that it's had. And we need to remember that this doctrinal system, this screwed up system, has entered the very highest echelons of power in this country. You have people, certain senators, that buy into this doctrine. You have the influence of this doctrine even as high as the National Security Council with people like Brett Scowcroft and so on. You saw it at work with the Reagan administration and ever since. So we have to understand that this is a cultural thing as well as a political phenomenon. It's a spiritual phenomenon. And people have to quit being so theologically illiterate in this country, if I can put it in those terms. It's always astonishing to me. And then, you know, beyond just the Christian stuff, then you get the secularized versions of it, you know, where there's no reference to Christian doctrine at all. that you and I have discussed many times, you know, well, there's all this money awash in the system. We're going to have hyperinflation any minute now. The dollar's going to come crashing down on such and such a date. Well, no, the dollar isn't going to come crashing down on such and such a date. For that to happen, America has to significantly lose a major portion of its military strength. And it's just a matter of thinking through these things with a little common sense.
Well, you know, it's interesting that the Economist had a very fascinating article, a special report on the dollar, and talked essentially saying, announcing the beginning of the end, that the dollar couldn't, you know, be sustainable as the reserve currency on the current trajectory. So, you know, it went through all that stuff. But one of the things it made clear was that there was no replacement for the dollar and how long a process this was going to be.
Exactly.
You know, it was very grounded. It was a very, you know, they did an excellent job of sort of describing where we are and sort of the baseball and the currency system.
And
right.
it was
interesting because I've had so many conversations over the last 2 years where people say, you know, the dollar is going to collapse tomorrow. I just,
no,
you know,
no, ain't going to happen.
Yeah, my favorite
happen.
One is the
Asian elders are going to show up and save us all. And, the elders collapsing tomorrow, and the Asian elders are going to show up and save us. This gets out of fear porn and into adult fairy tales.
It's the opposite of fear porn.
And the reality is, you know, when you have a country where people are making less than 10,000, you know, have a per capita income of less than 10,000 and are struggling with serious environmental problems, why would they take all their capital and come help us?
Exactly. Exactly. and especially, why would they do so when they are trying to put into existence their own parallel versions of financial clearing, when they're trying to position their currency to be a you know, the reserve currency? Well, they're not going to waste time helping us.
Right.
You know, this makes no sense.
So, to me, one of the most important stories of the third quarter is now what you bring up, and that is, you know, we started this year with a clear recognition that the United States and China had gotten along quite well because China basically financed our government checks,
which
paid people to go down to Walmart and buy Chinese stuff, and around we went. And, you know, and that worked until 2007. And then we kept it all going with debt, and China built lots of infrastructure and lots of housing. And now we've arrived at the point where we really do have to rebalance
both economies.
And the reality is, if you look at China's options, you know, America says we'll build a consumer and service market. Well, that's all well, nice and good, but the Chinese don't have the personal capital to run around and go spend. They've got to save for their retirement.
Right, exactly.
And, you know,
they've got an aging population. So what does China do? Say, well, you know something, we'll go finance lots of infrastructure all around Asia. And America throws a hissy fit and says, oh, no, you won't, because that threatens our position in the world order. But meantime, they're saying, we need you to grow. But we need you to grow in a way that carries us with you. China is saying, how? How do we do that?
So,
well,
you know,
yeah.
I think
what really has to happen, Catherine, is the United States has to decouple itself very carefully and over the long term from this reliance on China. And we've talked about this before. We need to bring, first of all, we need to bring actual manufacturing back to this country. Secondly,
and we are.
We are. Yeah. But secondly, our infrastructure in this country is in absolute tatters. I mean, it doesn't take much travel around the country on the interstate or the highway system to realize that a lot of it is in serious, serious need.
Well, I would say this. Our infrastructure above ground.
Oh yeah,
is in tatters. I'm beginning to think our infrastructure below ground is pretty sweet.
Oh yeah, I'm agree with you there. You can't have all those trillions of dollars since the end of World War II and not have some pretty interesting underground infrastructure. But the other thing I think we need to do, and we need to do post haste, and tout suite, as my French grandmother used to say, is to patch up our relationship with South America. And we need to do it in a big hurry because China and
right.
Russia are entering South America in a major way. And you can't blame South America because, you know, we've been the big brother with the big stick more often than
right.
not, interfering in a very bad, negative way in their internal affairs. We need to be the China to South America and help with their infrastructure and so on and so forth. In other words, we need to rebuild the basis of power that made American power possible in the
right.
first place, and that was to have a manufacturing base in this country, and that was to have an infrastructure that could support it. Our railroads are dilapidated. They need to be built out and built up. You know, there's no reason America should not have high-speed rail service like they do in Europe and Japan and
right.
places in China. There's no need for, you know, our trains to be trundling along at a breezy 30 miles an hour down the railroad tracks.
Right. Right.
We could be moving immense amount of goods by rail and moving it quickly if we spend the money to do it. So
right.
we need to do all these things. But for me, I think the other thing we need to do, and we need to do in jig time, is, you know, again, I'm going back to what we've been discussing with Russia and Syria and the Middle East, is we've seen the Russians demonstrate now some capabilities. In fact, before we came and began our interview, Catherine, I was reading a story about a launch of a satellite, a Russian satellite, and they can't figure out what this thing is. And I can tell you exactly what it is. It's a spy communications and interference satellite, because the Russians have placed this satellite in orbit where it's within about 5 kilometers of one of our intel sats. Okay? So in other words, this thing is gobbling up all of our communications. So the other thing we need to do is we need not only to build out our infrastructure on this planet, we need to secure our space infrastructure, and that means,
right.
you know, an expenditure that thus far I don't see the government willing to make. But, you know, if we're going to keep our international financial clearing going, if we're going to keep our domestic financial clearing going, we need to respond to some of these potential dangers that are coming down the pipe now from Russia and China. And I would go so far as to say, if you've been following the space angle of international geopolitics and finance, the other thing that I've noticed recently is that Europe and Russia have decided, well, we're going to go to the moon. So in other words, this is another indicator that Europe is breaking away. And
right.
if we're going to compete, we need to beef up our space program tremendously. And
right.
again,
I agree.
This is not being done.
Well, this gets back to, you need leadership that's very interested in the long-term strategic position.
And rebuilding
yes.
it.
Yes, exactly. And when you look at the current political candidates, you really don't see any. There's
no
real leaders. I mean, we get the same tired, tired, worn-out socialism from Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, but Donald Trump is really simply tapping into the cynicism in the body politic. He's not really offering, as far as I can tell, any detailed plans.
I have to confess, I looked at all the candidates and said, okay,
if you had to, is there anyone here that you could possibly vote for? And I confess, there was one. If I had to, I could vote for Kasich, because he has the experience with the federal budget and with the infrastructure of governance in Washington to run that office and to also staff a government. You know, so he is competent to staff a government and run the government and to understand the important issues and take care of them. But he's the only one I see in there that is.
Yeah, and what does that say about the state of American politics, really? Because he's not really a major front-runner contender. And I agree with you. He probably is the one.
Well, but that's
there
because right now
people
are looking for entertainment.
Yeah, they're looking.
I guess
well,
that's my,
they're not only
my
looking
other problem.
For that,
Why
but
are
they're,
we looking
they're
for
looking,
entertainment?
they're looking for the quick fix, you know, the demagogue that comes in and waves the magic wand and fixes everything. But this isn't going to happen. And people need to start taking long-term views of politics rather than, you know, every selection cycle and then go home. I'm totally agreed with you, but my point here is that we don't really see a field of candidates in for the most part that is capable of doing any of this. What we see are stars and entertainment, like you say. And
well, my favorite comment on the election so far was from Don Cox. He said, look, the presidency of the United States is not an entry level position.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, the major theme for the third quarter wrap up is the Chinese stock market, and one of the reasons is that I spent an enormous amount of time researching and looking at the stock market, really to come down to a final question or answer to the question of what should an investor do, because if China and America are going to engage in economic warfare that basically destroys stock market performance, you know, there's nobody wants to invest in a battle zone. So the question is, you know, there's no point in investing in China if China's not going to be allowed to succeed. So, you know, I had a lot of research and ruminating, but I think it's at the heart of the question of the global order. There's no way we can, you know, the bull market in bonds is over. So now we're going to have to move to an equity or a more equity-based model. And the reality is an equity-based model work unless we can compete and cooperate within certain parameters that allow us to perform economically instead of destroy economically. And that at the heart of that is the question, can we emerge a new set of global institutions that allow us to do that? And looking back at the third quarter, the answer is, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know, because, you know, China, if you look at all the different things China can do to grow its economy and keep its growth going, most of those things are not acceptable to the United States.
Right. I think there's several things that we have to look at as far as the possibility of growth, you know, real growth, not finance capital growth, but real growth.
Right.
And I go back to something that you've mentioned many, many times over the past few years, and that is local equity-based economies. Economies mm-hmm. that serve the locality. And you've mentioned this earlier today, as a matter of fact, with the idea of escrow accounts for education, to keep things local and make the schools work again and pay teachers decent salaries and free them up from this onerous, teachers go through so much of their time having to jump through hoops set by the state governments, by the federal government in continuing education, that they have very little time anymore really to teach the subjects that they're hired to teach. They're constantly preparing for yet another test, yet another assessment, and so on and so forth. We have to begin the process of real growth by understanding that education is very much a part of that.
Right.
We have to understand this, and we have to have teachers that are allowed to teach English and history and so on and so forth, and allowed to teach to the subject. In other words, I read an article recently before the interview where even our textbooks are now under fire because of their absolutely deplorable state. The level of learning and scholarship in our textbooks, particularly in the so-called soft disciplines like history, are absolutely deplorable. There's no other word other than deplorable.
Well, here's the thing. You have
all this sort of centralization going on. So I think of Common Core as sort of Bill Gates's wet dream, you know?
Yeah.
And if you look at all of these ridiculous things, they are destroying productivity and soaking up an enormous amount of time and creating a huge amount of shadow work for, you know, or destroying the health and nutrition of hundreds of millions of people. And those people can't be productive if they're struggling under these basically taxes. I mean, Common Core is a huge tax.
Yes, it is.
And so the question, you know, the equity market is saying be productive.
Yes, but, exactly.
But all these policies are saying, no, we're going to destroy and harvest your productivity. And something's got to give. And from what I'm seeing before I left the country, people were angry.
Well, and rightly so, because they can't, I mean, they literally can't turn anywhere to do anything without interference or corporate privilege from of one sort or another getting in the way. So we go back to the local equity-based model. I think this is fundamental to your insight of things and how to fix the system, and I'm totally in agreement with it. You have to get back to local control of education. You have to reward good teaching by paying a sufficient salary to teachers that are good teachers. And secondly, and the only way to determine that is not through a standardized test, but at the local level with engagement, personal engagement with the teachers.
Well, it goes across,
it goes across the budget, because you can't keep paying taxes to pay a large corporation $125 an hour, which to do something that someone locally would love to do for $15 plus healthcare.
Exactly. And the other thing, you know, is to take that model and then expand it to local infrastructure projects or local manufacturing projects. In other words, you know, we have been on this centralization binge, really, since Woodrow Wilson and then the big impetus that it got after World War II. But, you know, the model was fine for fighting the Cold War. But it's not fine for fighting what we're doing today. And this is the other problem that the deep state in America has, is its playbook is no longer capable of addressing the issues. And power has to be decentralized. And the only way I can see to do that is precisely to do what you've been suggesting, and that's local equity, local escrow accounts for education, and so on and so forth. Otherwise, it's not going to get fixed. And if it doesn't get fixed, I don't care what centralized policy or what mercantilist policy to favor the big corporations you put into place, ultimately, the system will collapse, and the very corporations that are looting are going to be their own victims. You know, the parasite is going to eat the host that it feeds upon. And with
I don't see the corporations, you know, because I think of corporations as a more granular phenomena, you know, but a lot of the corporations need the average consumer to be successful.
Yeah, they do. And they're killing. So, that's precisely my point. They're killing the engine that's driving their own profit margin.
Well, it's very interesting, you know, because I give them a lot of credit for doing this. So I brought this up before. Howard Schultz, the chairman of Starbucks, after the debates, the first Republican debates, came out and made a big stink about this country needs servant leadership. You know, this is not what we need. We need servant leadership. And that's a very courageous thing for somebody running a big public company to do. I mean, he made quite a stink, but he was dead right. And that's because if you look at his economics, he needs the country to succeed.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I dare say he's doing more, you know, exceptional training of young people than most schools. So,
the other thing that he's precisely right. We, you know, we've mentioned this before. We do need servant leadership. But what does that mean? That means people that are able to use even the vocabulary that shows that this is part of their philosophy. In other words, when was the last time, you know, I asked people, when was the last time that you heard people talking about the public good? And by public good, I don't mean Democratic Party welfare programs, you know, a free phone for everybody. That's not what I mean. I mean things that are good for the long-term benefit of every individual in the country. And the only way to do this is to, you know, I'm going back to Ronald Reagan here, who talked a long talk but didn't walk the walk. and that is to get government out of the way. Get it out of the way. Let people live their lives and create their dream, and then things will work. You can't do it through regulation. You can't do it through mercantilist policies like Common Core and GMO foods and so on and so forth. You just can't do it.
Well, Joseph, it's been absolutely fantastic talking about you. I feel much more excited about coming back to America.
Because I know there's sanity there.
Deep in the heartland, there's a sane, coherent voice speaking to me. So before we close, are there any other thoughts about the third quarter that we haven't covered that you'd like to bring up?
Well, I'm trying to think hard about that, but... No, the only thing I would try and recap here is we need to get away from let's put it this way, Catherine, we are obsessed as Americans with every federal election cycle, and we need to get away from that.
It's completely irrelevant.
It's completely irrelevant. We need to start looking at our locality. We need to start looking at our families. We need to be in contact with those teachers in our local school districts that are suffering under this hideous educational system that
right.
we've constructed in the last 150 years. We need to support our local ma and pa, you know, grocery
right.
stores and what have you,
right.
which I try and do. You know, when I go grocery shopping, I try and do most of it at local chains or, you know, organic food stores. And, you know, I'm like everybody else. I admit I go to Sam's occasionally, but... We need to start spending our money where it's going to do the most good for the health of the country, and quit obsessing about the latest Democratic or Republican, you know, non-debate on television.
Well, you know, I'm always shocked. It happens to me every 4 years that
anybody pays any attention, because, you know, if you saw. You know, what the candidates in the last election or the last two elections said was completely irrelevant to what they did.
Yep. Now, that's been true my whole life.
But I don't know why anybody thinks what anybody says in this process is relevant.
Yeah, I agree.
So,
you know, and the one thing I hate to say, you know, because I've been struggling. I've now written a 7-part series called Promoting Women. And it's all about this idea of America, you know, is the woman-friendly nation, and we're promoting women, and women make great leaders, and all this. You know, I've been trying to figure out, okay, what's the deal here? Because I'm convinced if you kind of look at who's pushing this, it's very much coming from the billionaires.
Sure.
And
there was a great interview with U.S. Trust the other day that I posted when I wrote Promoting Women, Part 7. And essentially what they said is if you look at the GNP of women, it's $15 trillion globally, which is bigger than China. And so the U.S. and women, you know, are so much bigger than China.
Yeah.
And I realized, oh, of course, with mobile marketing, one-on-one marketing, you know, the U.S. can literally reach every woman through a mobile phone. And so if they can get the women, you know, they can trump China.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep. And
absolutely.
So that's why,
you know, it absolutely makes no difference who's in the seat, but, you know, but the brand for marketing purposes is important, and which tells me that this is going to get, in terms of an election cycle, this is going to get far more separated from reality than it even is now.
Well, it is. And, you know, this brings up the other two points or makes me think of two more things. We first of all have to get away in this country of thinking in terms of the group. In other words,
right.
we need to start looking at people as individual persons rather than, you
right.
know, and I know that sounds like a truism, but look at people
right.
as persons and what they're capable of rather than as women or blacks or whites or Hispanics
right.
or young or old. You know, we've got to get out of the group mentality. We've got to do this even to the point of watching how we speak.
Right.
And getting this Balkanization out of our vocabulary. It starts there. We've got to start controlling the discourse. The second thing I think we need to look at, to go back to Europe for a moment, is we need to start looking very carefully at countries like Italy, Spain, Portugal, Hungary. We need to start paying attention to these countries because there are movements in those countries now that are beginning to challenge, and I think justifiably so, although some of their manifestations tend right now to be rather extreme. We need to start looking at these countries because there are movements now beginning to challenge some of the underlying philosophical assumptions of Mr. Global in those countries. You can look at the Spanish Catalonian secession movement, which I really think if the Spanish people wake up and realize that what they're really talking about isn't so much corruption in Madrid, it's corruption that's coming from this globalist philosophy that has reigned in Madrid, and the same thing in Budapest. You go to Hungary and you get the current Hungarian president talking now about Hungarian culture, Hungarian nationhood, and things like this. We're seeing local movements challenging the whole globalist meme, which I think if we handle correctly and we tailor the debate correctly, these can be positive things rather than degenerate into the kind of right-wing sort of neo-fascist movements that they can often degenerate into. So these are places to watch.
One of my favorite quotes of the last week is one of my great allies said,
how do we take advantage of high tech without it taking advantage of us?
Exactly.
Well, in closing, I just want to point out that you and I in 2 weeks are going to be together outside of Austin, Texas.
That's
right. At the Secret Space Program.
Which I'm very excited about because last year really was a life-changing
experience. It really was. And
well, I'm excited about it too. I have to tell you why.
Well, take a second and tell us why and tell us what you're going to be talking about.
Well, I'm excited because of the speaker list at this conference. It's I think it's an even better lineup than the one last year, and chiefly because two of my favorite people, scientists, are going to be there speaking. Dr. John Brandenburg is going to be there. He's a plasma physicist from Los Alamos. Is going to be talking, I think, about his book about nuclear warfare on Mars, which is a fascinating topic. Oh, yeah.
Yes, it is.
And, yeah. And then Dr. Paula Violette will be there, who wrote a fascinating book called Secrets of Anti-Gravity Propulsion. He's been tracking these alternative propulsion technologies for many, many years. He will be speaking. A mutual friend of ours, Walter Bosley, will be speaking. Jay Dyer is a new individual that's going to be speaking about the meme of secret space programs in Hollywood movies, which I think will be very interesting. Linda Moulton Howe, of course, who's been a major mainstay in this type of research for many years with her research on mutilations, on crop circles and things like that. So I'm really looking forward to it, not so much because I'm speaking, but principally so I can listen to everybody else speak. but I'll be talking about what I call the Versailles template that I think was part of the formation, the policy formation culture of the national security establishment. It's going to be kind of a dry, you know, sort of history lesson pulling together some threads that I've kind of thrown out there in this interview and that interview, trying to pull it all together and say, well, this is why I think this is an important thing to consider. So it's going to be an interesting conference.
I know if everybody goes to your website or my website, they can access the discount code and still sign up to come to Austin if you want, or sign up and just get the stream and, you know, come in on the internet. So, yeah, It's going to be a good one. Now, also, we have new subscribers, Joseph, so I'm going to have to ask you to explain your website and
what people can find there, and tell a little bit about some of your most recent books, if you will.
My subscribers area has principally a lot of vid chats. I do every 2 weeks vid chats with my members that send me questions, and then I go through and comment on the questions. They're usually quite long, about sometimes three, as many as 5 hours long. We have an interesting time talking about all sorts of stuff. It's a way for people to interact with me personally and get detailed answers. I have a few webinars on the website in the members area where I talk about different topics. I've been planning to do some more. I've just never had the time to do it. The website is www.gizadeathstar.com. I do have public blogs on the website that are, you know, free. They're not subscription. They're free to anybody. The latest book I did was called The Third Way.
And it's a doozy.
It's a doozy. It talks about some of what we talked about earlier today with war on terror and Islam and weaponization of Islam and all of that stuff. It's a doozy. But and I have another book with a co-author who's writing pseudonymously with me in this book coming out next year on Common Core. I'm in the process of researching another major book right now, which I hope I'll have out next year sometime.
Well, it was phenomenal because we just had a wonderful lunch in Amsterdam.
Uh-huh. And there were people present from the European precious metals community, dealers.
Oh, my.
We had people who were from the...
actually formerly the fixed income markets, but from the successful business community. We had members of the German media.
We had
people from the free energy community and sponsors of
Secret Space Program.
So we had many different nationalities represented, and many, and all of them at various times during the conversation quoted you in your books.
And oh, I said, wow, cool.
Now that is reach.
Oh, cool. Well, that made my day. Well, cool.
Yeah, no, it was pretty cool. And what was remarkable is whenever they did, no one said, "Who's he?"
Well, that's good.
Yeah. No, it was "Oh, you know Dr. Farrell?" "Oh, yeah. Oh, well, I'm impressed." Anyway, so I consider that a sign that you've reached intellectual cloutdom. Anyway, so with that,
I look forward to seeing you again.
Yeah, we're going to talk in the fourth quarter. I'm just giving you a heads up. Our annual wrap up, the theme is going to be the space-based economy. So we're going to keep the space economy conversation going throughout the quarter, and I know you're going to have a lot to say on it. So until the fourth quarter, well, the it'll be the annual wrap up. Joseph, thank you so much. You have a wonderful quarter. Okay.
Yeah, you too, Catherine. We'll see you in Austin, and
see
have
you
a safe
in Austin.
Flight. God bless. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye.